This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're learning about the bubonic plague during the Middle Ages, what impact the historic event had on labor markets, and what we can learn about the pandemic we're living through by looking into the past. This conversation was a live panel discussion hosted on Friday by the University of Notre Dame's Medieval Institute. It was moderated by Indiana Public Broadcasting's workforce reporter, Justin Hicks. And in it, you'll hear from experts on labor, medieval history, and sociology.
Today's program is a roundtable discussion on post-pandemic labor markets. To be clear, we're still currently in a pandemic, but today we're going to take a look at how history might help us understand labor market changes we're already seeing and maybe even help us anticipate some new changes that are yet to come. We'll explore parallels between our new normal these days and 14th century Europe, where the bubonic plague was rampant. We'll also compare the current perception of a worker shortage in present times with medieval work conditions and labor laws that came about in the wake of the Black Plague. So I hope you're excited as I am, but first, let's introduce this great lineup of panelists we have here. Daniel Hobbins, to my left, is an associate professor of history at Notre Dame. He specializes in the cultural and intellectual history of late medieval Europe. And under this broad heading, his research has focused on colophons, is that correct? Colophons? Yeah. Authorship, Joan of Arc, and backgrounds to print. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, and thanks for coming.
Yeah. On the other side of the table, Dan Graff. He's the director of the Higgins Labor Program, which is dedicated to the importance of the labor question to all human endeavors. That is, who does the work, who gets the fruits of that labor, and who makes the rules? His current research projects include labor licensing codes of conduct in contemporary American universities, race, labor, and citizenship in 19th century St. Louis, and representations of the chronic crisis facing workers in the U.S. since 1981. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Justin. Happy to be here. And thanks to the Medieval Institute for hosting.
And then finally, joining us via Zoom, hovering above our heads here, we have Tamara Kay. She's a professor of global affairs in the Keough School of Global Affairs, and holds an appointment in Notre Dame's Department of Sociology. Her research and teaching focus on the political and legal implications of regional economic integration, transnationalism, and global governance for labor and environmental movements, NGOs, and policy formation. Hi, Tamara.
Hello, everybody. Welcome home for some of you.
All right, so let's set the stage a little bit for where we're kind of at right now, before we kind of go back in time to the 14th century. Tamara, I'm going to throw this question at you. Hopefully you can hear me okay. First things first, can you explain to us what this term labor market means? We've kind of thrown that around a little bit, but what does that encompass when we talk about labor markets?
So a labor market, also known as a job market, is very simple. It's basically referring to the supply and demand of labor. And employees provide the supply and employers provide the demand. And some key indicators or variables we'd be interested in thinking about labor markets are at the macro level, at the sort of broader scale, unemployment rates and labor productivity rates. And at the micro scale, individual wages and numbers of hours worked, things like that.
Got it. And does that, that sounds like it involves maybe a lot of data crunching there, a lot of number crunching, or what kind of numbers do you look at specifically?
Yeah. So, the ones relevant to pre-COVID, post-COVID would be something like, the unemployment rate. So actually the unemployment rate right before COVID began in February 2020 was about 3.5%. A month later in March, it was about 4.4%, and it peaked at a high of almost 15%, just under 15%, in April 2020, which actually was the highest rate observed since data collection began in 1948. And then since then, we've seen a decline. The unemployment rate has fallen to about 5.4% as of July. And then another variable we look at is what we call labor force participation. So by April 2020, labor force participation had declined to about 60.2%, a level not seen since the early 1970s. And then we began a partial recovery in May 2020. So, we saw a decrease in jobs, in non-farm jobs. We saw different economic sectors impacted disparately, particularly in leisure and hospitality sectors. And we also saw differences in gender, bigger impacts on women, bigger impacts on people of color. And so those are the kinds of data that we're looking at.
Yeah, and you know, the unemployment rate, I know that's a big one that we've talked about a lot in the past 2 years or so, both because it was historically low before the pandemic and then it suddenly became historically high. Can you explain a little bit of how do we capture that number? How does the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who publishes that, I know, what's the process they go about?
So every month they collect data on how many people are employed. And so the data is actually very good and very consistent. It's some of the best data that we actually have. And so it's looking at different sectors. It's looking at different genders. There are surveys of workers. And so we have a lot of information on a monthly basis in the United States about what's happening with the unemployment rate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dan Graff, I'm going to pass this over to you. So today we're seeing a lot in the media about a worker shortage, although that's kind of contested as well, right? I mean, it's not necessarily clear that there is a worker shortage, depending on who you ask. So, you know, we drive around, we see this evidence when we're driving down the street and we see the Taco Bell and the KFC saying, now hiring, and, you know, all these big signs. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I would say it's great to have Tamara as a sociologist tag teaming with me in the contemporary period. I'm a historian like Dan is, but a U.S. historian, and focus increasingly on contemporary labor questions. So, you know, my answer to the question about a labor shortage is that it's yes and no. I mean, yeah, it's definitely true. Many employers are struggling to find workers. But at the same time, we have an official unemployment rate. I think now it's about 5.2%, about double for African Americans compared to whites. That's still higher than before the pandemic. And there are still 5 million fewer jobs in the U.S. economy than there were prior to the pandemic, which suggests we haven't fully recovered as an economy. I think the way to reconcile that we have both millions of workers unemployed with employers unable to find workers is that we're in a really unsettled moment in the economy right now. We're still in the pandemic, as Justin said. There's all sorts of questions for workers about safety at the workplace, problems of parents or those who provide some kind of care to others in their home. How do they get care for the people that they are worried about with childcare possibly closed, all sorts of COVID-related issues of welcoming people into your home. Some schools are still not reopened or only partially reopened. So there's all sorts of reasons why some employers aren't finding workers as quickly as they'd become accustomed to before the pandemic. But I think, and this is where I put on my historian's hat, an additional and perhaps bigger factor is the chronic problem of pay in the United States. I mean, we have had persistent flat hourly wages for ordinary workers for the past 4 or 5 decades, and a complete decoupling of economic productivity from workers' wages. And we've continued to have this very productive economy despite the 2008 recession and the blip, the pandemic, which is, you know, significant as well. Despite that, we've had productivity gains over the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, but we haven't created that many good jobs to go along with those productivity gains. And workers in this pandemic / post-pandemic moment are increasingly hesitating to take crappy jobs that they would have in the past. Again, it's complicated, I think, what's going on. But we're seeing workers individually saying no more to the old employment relationship, the pre-pandemic employment relationship. And we are seeing some wages rise. We're seeing starting pay getting boosted. But we're seeing a lot of squawking by employers about having to pay those higher wages. I think it's a good thing that pay is rising and maybe there's a perception of a labor shortage, especially in really low wage brackets. You know, in a capitalist economy, demand for labor is supposed to produce higher wages to attract workers. And on some level, that's what we're seeing. I feel like employers and the public in the U.S. are so used unused, I guess, to that situation, that they're flummoxed by this, and many are starting to cry foul. Workers don't want to work. The work ethic is disappearing in this country, but I think in the context of that flat pay for a generation, we're still playing catch up when it comes to wages going up. And I think we should be happy to see low wage workers both benefiting with some modest pay raises as well as flexing muscle that causes inconvenience to us as consumers, frankly.
Yeah. Well, you talked about as well, you know, people saying essentially, you know, well, people are just lazy right now. People don't want to work. And I know in my reporting, I've reported a lot on unemployment insurance over the past year and a half. Something I've thought about a lot is, you know, this idea of, you know, the quote-unquote welfare queen kind of myth that went around a lot and that suddenly became attached in people's minds to unemployment insurance. I mean, are there, do you think there's sort of harmful, maybe stereotypes is the right word, that you think are attached to this idea of people are just lazy?
Yeah, I very much worry about that. I mean, it's the hospitality and the leisure sectors, I think, which create lots and lots of low-paid jobs with little room for advancement. These are the ones suffering the labor shortages the most. Hotel workers, food service workers. And they're just not accustomed to that. It's not just about low pay. Again, it's about the prospects for, like, what I would call sane scheduling. The ability to have a decent, predictable schedule, reliability of hours, as well as the notion that used to be very customary in the United States of upward mobility, the sort of internal job ladders within companies, career pathways. I have seen stories recently about employers, like just a sort of text analysis of job ads, where there's like a 30% boost in companies like Amazon and other firms that start people out at close to the bottom of the wage bracket, emphasizing more about benefits like tuition assistance, as well as just words like career path and training opportunities. So whether that's going to gain some larger traction and produce a longer trend, I don't know.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're bringing you a live panel discussion hosted on Friday by the University of Notre Dame's Medieval Institute about the bubonic plague and how pandemics throughout history have impacted labor markets. I'm Miriam Soap. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soab. Today we're bringing you a live conversation hosted on Friday by the University of Notre Dame's Medieval Institute. It's about the bubonic plague, also known as the Black Death, the effect it had on labor markets, and what we can learn from pandemics throughout history. It's moderated by our workforce reporter Justin Hicks and features three guests from Notre Dame: Daniel Graff, director of the Higgins Labor Program; Daniel Hobbins, an associate professor of history; and Tamara Kay, a professor of global affairs and sociology.
I am going to pass over here to Daniel Hobbins. So, you know, of course, this event's being put on by the Medieval Institute, and so you may be wondering where that kind of comes in. Daniel Hobbins, obviously labor markets have been a thing for centuries, right? And can you tell us a little bit about the 14th century specifically, because we're talking about the Black Death here, which that's when it occurred. What was the labor market like then?
Right. Sure. So Black Death, as historians use that term, really to the initial outbreak, which is 1347 to 1350, and then you can talk about plague, but Black Death usually refers to that initial outbreak. The main point is there are far more people working in agriculture in the medieval world. Probably 90% of people people that we would think of as laborers would be working in agriculture outside of cities. In cities, labor, which are much smaller than our cities today, and that would include towns and villages, labor would be concentrated in, if we think of crafts, the craft guilds, which had very strict rules for admission. They're quite different from labor unions. We can talk about that later if you want. Mm-hmm. But that would include everything from that term masks a great deal of variety. You could go all the way down to people like tanners who are working with dead animals, and it's a job that's unclean, and they're relegated to certain parts of the city, and all the way up to goldsmiths who are quite wealthy. And then beyond that, a sort of third category would be a merchant class, people who are doing the buying and selling and trading.
So you sort of have your farmers, your artisans, and then your merchant class. Was there a nobility structure at all?
Well, yeah, that's outside of this. I mean, as the medievals themselves classified their world, they're the people who fight in this. Those who pray the church, those who work the class I just talked about, but really working the soil is what those people are in that scheme. And then those who fight, the noble class, which was a very small percentage of the population.
Kind of like the 1% in a way.
Right.
Yeah. I watch too much TV and, you know, yeah. you see that's what we see when we watch the medieval TV, right? We see the nobles. And the
right. I mean, the knights are at the bottom of that, and they're working their way up into that class, but they would have thought of themselves as part of the noble class.
Gotcha. Okay. Great. Well, tell us about this Black Death. And, I mean, what was this plague, and what impact did it have on labor?
Well, it was plague. That's the first point. There was a doubt about that among historians until really quite recently about what disease it actually was. And that's really been settled now through the DNA testing of plague cemeteries. So that's a bubonic plague. Yersinia pestis is the agent. So that debate is over. There are different forms of it, some that could be transmitted, some from fleas, from rodents to fleas to humans, others another way would be from humans to humans. The estimated death rate for the Black Death is, and that means for that initial outbreak, is really astonishingly high, from one third to one half of the population in Europe.
Wow.
Europe doesn't recover population that it had before 1348 until the mid-16th century. But it's even worse than that, because then you have the recurrence of plague. Every 10 years it could be. In some places there's probably always plague, but if you're in one city, every 10 years you might get a recurrence of plague. So it becomes a permanent part of the world of people all the way up into the 18th and 19th century, and then late 19th century you get modern plague showing up, which is again related to the, it might not be exactly the same disease, but it's very close.
So it was sort of the old new normal, if you will.
Right. No, it is. That's right.
Yeah. Well, there was a big time of upheaval in sort of social classes because of this plague, right? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, everything was in upheaval, if you can imagine. I mean, can you imagine? One-third to one-half. We had a tiny, tiny percentage of 1%, and here we have one-third to one-half. So it's a scale of mortality that is kind of almost impossible for us to imagine. So, yes, social classes were in upheaval. For a time, everything just completely shuts down. And then what you have is... economists have kind of can study this, and we know that wages shoot up in over the next century. It doubles the real buying power of people, in part because of a scarcity of labor. That's relevant, perhaps, to today's conversation. Prices decline at first, but then they actually go up for a very long time. So wages are going up, but you aren't able to buy everything more cheaply. And then we have evidence through so-called sumptuary laws of new behaviors of ordinary laborers now demanding meat and quality wines, for instance, and also dressing in a way that was only allowable actually for the noble classes. And we know this because we have laws saying they shouldn't be doing those things. There's this anxiety among the ruling classes about what we might say class, about these the class divisions are getting, the lines are getting crossed in ways that they shouldn't. So there's your upheaval.
Yeah, it makes you think of the, you know, our recent talks about inflation, right? Like, and I think about maybe even just gasoline, how this time a year ago, none of us were going anywhere. And so I was able to fill up my car in $20. And I hadn't been able to do that since I was a teenager, personally. I mean, a long time. And now, of course, gas is going right back up as we're sort of a little bit worried about inflation and trying to see where that goes. It kind of reminds me of that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, we don't have, you know, we should be clear and admit that we don't have the kind of robust data for this period that we have for, it's not even remotely similar. Even population estimates. But we have enough to have a sense of what's going on. And certainly, there was inflation. There was, and wages are rising. So it's actually, you know, arguably for those people who survived the Black Death, it's actually not a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, I do want to come back to you in a little bit with the role of guilds and other things. But I do want to pass this over to Dan Graff real quickly. And Tamara, feel free to jump in as well. But Dan, can you just start by reminding us of some of the economic disruptions we saw as a result of the pandemic? I mean, what did we see in the past year and a half or so? And also, too, were those things that we saw, were they the result of natural responses to COVID-19, or were they the result of responses to government shutdowns?
All right.
Big question.
Yeah. All of us lived through this, so maybe some of this is stuff you don't want to remember or you're still in the midst of. I think the disruptions were both government-imposed lockdowns, of course, that attempted to stem the pandemic, plus lots and lots of individual behavior showing up in collective form that shut down many, many parts of the economy throughout 2020. That sent the economy into recession, spiked unemployment. Tamara mentioned that earlier. I think of peaking at something like over 15%, but by some measures, the real unemployment rate was closer to 20%. And then you'll recall, of course, the serious debates, serious and not so serious, but serious consequences, certainly, about when, how, and on what terms to reopen the economies, first over masks, then over vaccines, now over both. We're still in the midst of it. The work of everyone was highly disrupted, of course, but it was in very different ways, some of which were class-based, right? So many ended up working from home. There's all sorts of implications for that about the home as a paid workplace. It's already an unpaid workplace. And with schools closed, that raised lots of questions. Others lost their jobs or were furloughed, some of them showing up in the unemployment numbers. And then others continue to work as before, right? These essential workers in meat processing plants or grocery stores or hospitals. At the Center for Social Concerns, which is where the Higgins Labor Program that I direct is housed here on campus at Notre Dame, we began a podcast called Speaking of Dignity, Workers on the Front Lines and the Common Good. We did several interviews of just a variety of workers in order to try to capture the diverse experiences. So I encourage people to check that out. Letter carrier, a food service worker, frontline nurse, that just trying to get a sense of people's experiences who were defined suddenly as essential workers and got a lot of attention paid to them, even though their own voices weren't often front and center in our discussion. So please check that out. I think the short-term response, primarily of the federal government, was in many ways very surprising and very admirable. I didn't live through the New Deal or the Great Society eras of expanded government, but expanding and extending unemployment compensation, creating paycheck protection programs so employers could keep people on the job, the extension and increase of the child tax credit, strengthening even FMLA, Family Medical Leave Act, giving workers paid time off for dependent care. But all those acts were temporary, right? We're still experiencing some of them, but they're written into law as temporary. And that's a concern to me. So my big takeaway, I guess, from the past year and a half has been that the rhetoric on essential workers has far outrun any policy changes protecting the safety or extending the rights or empowering the voices of those essential workers on the job. So I can leave it at that. I don't know if Tamara wants to weigh in as the fellow contemporary. scholar.
Maybe you did a great job. I'll comment on supply chains and trade issues.
No, yeah, I just wanted to give you an opportunity if you wanted to. Yeah. When you talk about PPP, Dan, one of the things, and when you talk to these essential workers as well, one of the things that I heard a lot from people when they were getting unemployment insurance and they were kind of getting this flack, they were getting this sense of flack, right? For like, why are you taking these government benefits? You know, do you deserve these? And then people I would talk to who were essential workers, they would say, well, how come it is when the businesses get PPP loans, you know, there wasn't a stigma attached to that? You know, if you got $17 million for your small business, that's maybe a lot, that's an exaggeration, but you know, there wasn't as much of a stigma to these PPP loans as there was to people who were accessing benefits. I mean, what does that kind of tell you about our society and maybe how we view work and labor?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. If you think of just sort of a classic capitalist theory, I mean, do we want to follow that in the sense of having an unemployed class of people to keep wages low, right? Certainly government policies in the modern era are designed to at least in part ameliorate the problems that people suffer from unemployment. They're supposed to be temporary bouts of it, rooted in no fault of their own, right? The sort of, they're victims of business cycles and the like. But I was very supportive of it and still am of robust unemployment compensation. I mean, I think the idea, I mean, we'll talk in a bit maybe about this notion of workers choosing the unemployment benefits rather than returning to jobs. But to me, the unemployment compensation system is not, it's the similar to Tamara's point about the welfare queen image. It's not like people are getting rich off the unemployment compensation system. If somebody can even stay temporarily unemployed and take some benefits, that's an indictment of our pay system more than it is an indictment of an individual worker's choice. But again, sort of historically, the unemployment compensation, right, I described what it was intended to do. It's already quite limited. And it's been deteriorating for the last few decades in terms of the people covered. It's like if wages have been flat in the United States for most workers, which they have, the sort of decline in coverage of the unemployment compensation programs, which are all administered by the states and vary quite a bit. New Jersey has way more coverage of workers. Something like 60% are eligible than a state like Florida, where seriously, something like 1 in 10 unemployed workers is covered. So even these, in my view, positive expansion of unemployment to cover people not usually covered by the federal benefits temporarily, gig workers, the self-employed, and the expansion of those, the temporary, I think it was $600 a month supplement by the federal government during 2020, and then it was passed again.
600 a week, actually.
600 a week, and then 300, I'm sorry. In 2021, when they repassed it after it expired, those are all gone now, right? Those have all ended. There was pretty crappy execution for some. So, like, a lot of people eligible never even got the pay. So, I think we need to think more broadly about what unemployment is supposed to do for somebody who's out of work. But this question about were the expanded benefits stopping people from going back to work? I mean, the studies that I've seen by economists, I'm a historian, but I do read economists from time to time, show that because the states have control over this, several, like 26 states, something like half the states, we had a natural experiment, ended the expanded benefits or the supplemental benefits early. And you compare that to the states that didn't. And the states, in terms of job performance and unemployment, the states that continued the program had mildly better numbers in terms of unemployment and job creation than the states that ended it early. So I don't think that's the big factor. Again, I'm in favor of it if it's preventing someone from having to go back to work in a job where they're just getting by. Maybe we need to rethink, you know, the whole system. But any impact was really on the margins in terms of that supplemental unemployment compensation. And again, if it gave some folks leverage, I think that's a good lesson for all of us. I mean, the other thing we often hear is about small business. And, you know, I understand that small businesses have a much harder time absorbing greater labor costs than large businesses. That's a fact, and I understand that. But I feel like how we define what a small business is, how many employees that is, as well as, you know, I feel like the small business is similar to Welfare Queen, and it becomes a trope or an ideal image, and that it's used to prevent policymaking that's going to positively impact millions and millions of workers. I mean, the vast majority of Americans who work for someone else work for an employer that has 100 or more employees. So, you know, 70, 75, 80%, something like that. So, you know, you do have to start thinking about where do we devote the resources that will impact the most people positively.
I think small businesses.
Like to. Oh,
sorry. 100 or more. 100 or more.
Yeah.
100 or more. But small business is often defined as 500 or fewer workers. Yeah. And then you, if you define it that way, it's a little less than half of those who work for others work for a small business. But if you define it as 100 or fewer, it's like 20, 30%, something like that.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're bringing you a live panel discussion hosted on Friday by the University of Notre Dame's Medieval Institute about the bubonic plague and how pandemics throughout history have impacted labor markets. I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today we're learning about the bubonic plague during the Middle Ages, what impact the historic event had on labor markets, and what we can learn about the pandemic we're living through by looking into the past. The live discussion was hosted on Friday by the University of Notre Dame's Medieval Institute. It's moderated by our workforce reporter, Justin Hicks, and features three guests from the school: Daniel Graff, director of the Higgins Labor Program, Daniel Hobbins, an associate professor of history, and Tamara Kay, a professor of global affairs and sociology.
Tamara, I also want to ask you a little bit about trade. Obviously, global trade has been affected a lot, and that's obviously affected the workforce as well in a lot of ways, because that trickles down, right? You know, from these companies to the workers. You know, how has trade been impacted by the pandemic, and what effects are we still seeing today?
Well, trade, you know, the trade activists, the activists who've been fighting for 35 years for what we call ethical trade that really meets people's needs instead of just the needs of corporations, have been arguing for decades that we would have a crisis like this. And, you know, what we saw in terms of the way that we've been setting up trade policy since the 1970s, which is to really benefit corporations, to undermine sovereignty of different nations, to be able to do domestic manufacturing or production. You know, some of that is beneficial, and some of it is really problematic when you hit a bump in the road or a, you know, boulder in the road. And so, you know, what we saw during the height of the pandemic was, you know, a real problem with supply chains where PPE wasn't being manufactured in the United States. One thing I was really concerned with, I do some work in global health, and there was a shortage of medicine. So when you intubate someone who has COVID-19, they get a sedative because it's basically putting a tube into their lungs. It's extremely painful. And most people are in tremendous pain and also try to pull all of these tubes out of them. And so basically we were running low on medication, the sedative and the painkiller that's used to intubate and extubate when people pass away. Patients. We had ventilator shortages. We had shortages of parts for ventilators. And we continue to see these kinds of shortages even today. So, but the greatest, I think, the greatest supply chain failure right now that we can all actually get involved with is that we have a shortage of vaccines around the world, right? So, you know, globally, a small fraction of people have been vaccinated in African countries. Most African countries, fewer than 10% of people have been vaccinated. And this largely has to do with, despite the fact that our money went into all the research to create these vaccines, public money, government money, these pharmaceutical companies still maintain a stronghold on the technology and production. And so, you know, countries in low resource countries are just not being able to produce and have the capacity to produce vaccines for their populations around the world. So, so trade, you know, enters into every facet, of how we have been, experiencing the COVID pandemic. And, I think we need to really rethink, trade policies and equitable and ethical trade policies in order to deal with some of these things.
Yeah, and with these shortages and those supply chain shortages going on, I think a lot about how, you know, Indiana is a very manufacturing heavy state, and we're actually also a very big pharmaceutical manufacturing state. We have Eli Lilly, kind of, you know, that we think of, and a couple other companies down towards Indianapolis. For a little while in manufacturing, the thing that's been in vogue is sort of the just-in-time, delivery of the parts. That way you don't have to have the warehouse to store the parts. They just come right into the factory. You get them in, you get them right back out. That's obviously caused a lot of these supply chain or a lot of these manufacturing slowdowns because the supplies are coming in slower. Have we seen any changes in that? Any changes in that kind of idea from companies about like maybe we should have one or two warehouses instead of just, you know, getting it in and getting it out?
You want me to answer that?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's really forced some companies to rethink that. But again, it depends on the sector. It depends on how different kinds of companies are benefiting, right? So right now there's a shortage of the fancy plastic bags that are used to mix chemicals to make medicine. It's not just the COVID pandemic, which is causing the shortage, though. It's caused by the fact that over the last 15 years, four firms have bought up the big biopharmaceutical equipment industry. And so none of our government agencies has taken any antitrust action to deal with that. So these firms have tremendous market power. And that means that, they make it so that the bags can only interoperate with their specific mixing machines. It's kind of like, you know, having a ton of coffee and Keurig machines, but not having the Keurig pods to be able to make your coffee, right? It's not a coffee shortage. So some companies benefit from this. The government has gotten involved several times since the 1970s in looking at certain sectors and industries and making recommendations for how, you know, the supply chain and how all of this should be better constructed. With our current trade agreements, it's being considered at the level of the World Trade Organization. But really, a big problem is, that there are benefits to maintaining these kinds of monopolies. We have a crisis in the auto industry right now because of the chips are not being produced. So, you know, we're seeing factories close. So it's just a domino effect, really. But there has to be incentives for the companies to actually change these structures and set up the warehouses or, you know, do domestic manufacturing in the United States for some of these products.
Yeah, specifically with that chip shortage, I know the Biden administration has been talking about maybe using the National Defense Production Act, I think that's what it's called, to possibly look at those supply chains and figure out how government can maybe step in and fix that. I want to jump back into the 14th century really quickly, though. Really hard left turn. We know trade probably wasn't as global in the 14th century as it is today, but I'm assuming trade was probably affected a little bit across Europe during this plague as well, the Black Death, right? I mean, what happened there?
Well, it's a very different conversation when you talk about trade in the 14th century. To begin with, I mean, they don't have the same conception of the need to close borders. Okay, we don't have a germ theory of disease. They do have a notion of contagion, and in fact, they did give people the advice, the very good advice, the plague tracks, which circulated. The best advice they gave was to, if the plague comes, get out of town. So there is this notion of contagion, but not a germ theory disease. So borders aren't being shut. People are still moving around. And in fact, the late medieval world, the 14th century world, is far more interconnected through trade than, say, the world of 1000 or certainly 800 in the Western Europe. So, in fact, the Black Death wouldn't have been transmitted as effectively as it was if this world weren't completely interconnected. Obviously, not as much as today. So it's evidence, in a way, the spread of the disease is evidence of a more interconnected world, and that would not change or go away. The period after the Black Death, saw great improvements in maritime transport, bigger ships, nautical tools, which is all the context for the Age of Discovery. So that's the context in which you can talk about trade. It's a very different conversation. So that's where, if we're talking about sort of relevance to today, I think it's interesting, but I don't know that it tells us about the world of today as much as maybe some other things we've talked about.
I'm sure. And it sounds like maybe the biggest, quote-unquote supply chain shortages may have even been from these farmers who, many of them, if they were dying, would not be able to bring that food to market, and maybe a food shortage or something.
Sure, yeah. And there would have been shortages initially. But the conversation, the modern conversation we're having about trade, is just so different. And I think it's challenging. I think it's a great conversation to have, to make these links. But when we get to trade, I find it harder. I find it harder to talk about. It's still worth trying.
Sure. Well, while we're still in the 14th century, because I want to ask these guys about labor unions, but while we're still in the 14th century, I also want to talk about the role of guilds and how they kind of compare to labor unions. I mean, what were the role of guilds?
Sure. So one key difference, the medieval guild, it's a fundamental difference, actually. The medieval guild includes both the owners of the industry and those who work in the industry. So it's all one, the masters and the apprentices. The masters own everything. They own the capital. Right? There's no company. There's no, in a way, there's no man, right? So both masters and laborers are part of these guilds. So that's a fundamental difference. Also, the guild was not just a labor organization. It was also a religious organization. There was usually a church attached to it or that the members attended. There were all kinds of rights and obligations and privileges unrelated to the work itself. So, for example, you would have to attend the funeral of one of your members. On the other hand, that meant that when you died, a lot of people came to your funeral. So these were social, very much social, more social than modern labor unions.
So much more like a fraternity almost.
Fraternities, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, cool. Well, Dan Graff, I was going to ask you about unions, right? What's been the role of unions throughout this pandemic and keeping workers safe and also navigating this sort of labor shortage, if we want to call it that, kind of time that we're in?
Yeah. First, I want to speak to Dan Hobbins' points, though, about guilds and thinking about, a lot of the, in an American history context, labor unions formed from some of the same impulses, right? Sort of craft-based. The first unions in the United States came out of the crafts when journeymen and apprentices organized in resistance to masters of those crafts getting to speak for them in that sort of old guild system. But the labor unions have always played, too, this fraternal role. A lot of them as much mutual benefit societies and taking care of their members in times of sickness or the families of members in times of death. So a lot of the roots are the same. This is one of the reasons why I think it's interesting studying the past. It's like, Dan's right that when we think of modern labor unions, we don't think of them in the same social way that we think of medieval guilds. And yet that really just raises a question about the evolution of labor relations and labor unions really only in the 20th century. And it might raise the question, this is a way like you think about the past, contrast it with the present, and then it might make you wonder, have labor unions lost some of that role that they played in an earlier era. I mean, I grew up in a union household. My dad is a retired pipe fitter, and he his union had a lot of aspects to it that went beyond enforcement of the contract at work and negotiating the wage. It was, you know, softball teams and picnics. There was all this way to sort of socialize the new members of the craft, so to speak. And so it might raise some interesting questions about the place of unions and what they do today. And maybe, you know, we talk a lot about the decline of social capital in the United States, and not just labor movements decline, but also lots of social organizations that once performed functions similar to these guilds. But I also think it's interesting just thinking about class in the medieval period, or cataclysmic events and the responses of societies, or the role of government in the economy. It's just, this is my plug to study history, whether it's the medieval period or the very recent. But I think, you know, wages have been flat in the U.S., third time I've said that, over the last four decades. Deterioration of the unemployment compensation system and other sort of government regulations of the workplace, the Department of Labor's enforcement of wage and hour standards, even the IRS, the sort of government agencies as regulatory bodies and enforcing laws has really declined. And the organized labor has declined precipitously. I think these are all attached to each other. So, you know, from 25% in the end of the 1970s, in the private sector now, we're like closer to 5% than 10%, I think. If you count the public sector, I think there's about 1 in 10 American workers are unionized. So I think, you know, in the midst of this pandemic, unionized workplace, I mean, people often compare and contrast union workplaces to non-union in the same sector to show the wage bump that somebody who's in a union gets from that. But it, to me, in the context of a pandemic, it goes way beyond that. There's just a lot of protect. I mean, unionized workers are more apt to have a healthcare plan. They're more apt to have benefits like the ability to take sick days off, or to take personal days to deal with family issues. So, you know, I would argue you're much safer in a unionized workplace in the midst of a pandemic like this, but it's a small, small percentage of the American population that's in there. And even work rules, you know, the sort of negotiation, the idea that you'd have to negotiate over how a business is going to operate in the midst of a pandemic. And if workers have a voice through the union, a say in negotiating that, that changes the dynamic. In a non-union workplace, an individual worker can voice her concerns, but, you know, she can also be let go without any reason by the employer, unless, you know, the employer is violating civil rights laws.
Well, I think that's about all the time we have for today. Thank you so much to everyone for coming. Let's kind of thank our panelists one more time here. Daniel Hobbins.
Thank you.
Yeah. We have Tamara Kay here on the screen. And Dan Graff.
You've been listening to a live panel discussion moderated by Indiana Public Broadcasting's workforce reporter, Justin Hicks. It was hosted on Friday by the University of Notre Dame's Medieval Institute. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.